From CBC Vancouver, it's This Canadian Life. I'm Sarah Campbell. Do you remember where you were when Joe Dick died? It's been 20 years since the punk rock legend took his own life live on camera. It's there for anyone to watch in the final moments of the 1996 documentary Hardcore Logo. Yet, 20 years later, there are still questions about Joe Dick's early death and lasting legacy. I was 16 in 1995, just a teenager growing up in a suburb outside of Vancouver. The Rock Against Guns benefit show was one of the first concerts I ever attended. I wasn't a huge fan of Hardcore Logo at the time, I was more interested in Flashback, but I was aware of Hardcore Logo's legend in the city. The importance of what I saw that night only became clear to me later on. Their live show impressed me, made me want to explore their back catalog. I was in the middle of doing this when the news of Joe's death broke, and it changed me in a fundamental way, the way that I view music and celebrity. Joe's death cemented my fascination with the band, setting up a lifelong obsession. Hardcore Logo got me seriously interested in music, which led me to journalism. It led me to where I am talking to you today. I like to think that everyone I meet, especially anyone in this city, cares about them just as much as I do, but it doesn't always work out that way. Hardcore Logo are a big deal, but only in certain circles. So, some facts for the uninformed. Hardcore Logo were formed in 1978 by Joe Mulgrew and William Bosey, the future Joe Dick and Billy Talent. They grew up together, started playing music together young. Their first band was named Peckerhead. They formed Hardcore Logo in 1978 with John Oxenberger playing bass and Duncan Pipefitter Butts on drums. Hardcore Logo toured relentlessly for 13 years before breaking up. And then in 1995, they reunited for a one-off benefit show, which turned into a tour across Western Canada that ended with Joe Dick's suicide. The last Hardcore Logo show was in Edmonton. They played half a set. Joe and Billy got in a fistfight and both left the stage. Then Joe Dick shot himself in the head. You can actually watch that happen. There's a documentary of their final tour which goes until the very end. Joe toasts the director and then shoots himself. I didn't see the film until several years later. It was released first overseas in hopes of finding proper North American distribution, which never materialized. I finally saw it at a midnight showing in my first year of university. It was later issued on home video and has become a cult classic for fans of the band. Considering how the days leading up to Joe's death are documented on film, there are a number of questions left unanswered. It isn't often that a band's dissolution is caught on film like this. There's some kind of monster, but Metallica made up in the end. It isn't clear how director Bruce McDonald influenced the events he documented. There are times in the film where it seems like he's manipulating the band, sharing or concealing pieces of information in a way that possibly wasn't ethical. It seems like McDonald may have been setting up a conflict between Joe and Talent that led to the final end of Hardcore Logo. Some have even suggested that McDonald should be held responsible for his role in Joe's death. Talent was noticeably absent from the premiere and all promotion of the film. At the time, he said, "McDonald's a hack. I lived through it, I'm not interested in seeing it on the big screen, and I don't know why anyone else would be." McDonald seems to have settled on understanding the film as a positive experience.
I'd never made a documentary before. I didn't know what it was going to be, but being a part of that was a real learning experience. I'm proud of the film we made. The end wasn't anything I expected, but it is what it is. I'm glad I had a chance to get to know Joe Dick and proud that my film was a chance for other people to get to know him too. He was one of a kind, and I know he's missed.
Whatever led to Joe Dick's death, whoever else played a role, it's why we're talking about him today. Where does Joe Dick rank on a list of great punk rock suicide? Below Cobain, certainly. Below Ian Curtin? Above Darby Crash? Researching this piece, I came across a 1986 interview with Maximum Rock and Roll, where Joe Dick talks about loving the Germs and their influence on Hardcore Logo. "I would have loved to see them play," he said. "It sounded like they put on a good show, like a f***ing riot, right? What's better than that?" The interviewer brings up that if Darby Crash hadn't died, there's a good chance they would have crossed paths. Hardcore Logo toured up and down the Pacific Coast. They played at the Germs' old stomping grounds in L.A. Joe seemed uninterested in the possibility. He said what he had to say, and then he went out. "If I had known what I'd wanted to say at 22, who knows if I'd be talking to you today, and if it wasn't my responsibility to provide a platform for Mr. Billy Talent's guitar god skills. One of the reasons why I was put on this planet was to make sure Billiam had someone to be in a band with." There it is. It's impossible to talk about Joe Dick without talking about Billy Talent. For a long time, Billy Talent refused to talk about Hardcore Logo. He flew straight from Edmonton to L.A. and became a part of the Jennifer machine. Talent stayed as Jennifer singer Sal Dallas replaced the original members with touring and studio musicians who wouldn't question his vision, lasting until 2001. When he left, he was Jennifer's longest-serving member. Since leaving Jennifer, Talent has released a handful of solo albums. In the past few years, Talent has been more willing to talk about his old band, and a few of their songs have shown up in his live set. At South by Southwest in 2011 to promote his latest solo offering, Talent joined John Oxenberger on stage for a cover of Blue Tattoo. Unsurprisingly, Talent declined to be interviewed for this feature. The other members of Hardcore Logo are a lot more talkative. John Oxenberger lives in Texas now and is happy to talk about his old band, but isn't sure what to say.
"It was a whole nother life back then. Another me. Joe's death broke my heart, but it also set me free. It made the ending of the band very final. It was possible to heal and move on. I could stop being John from Hardcore Logo and discover what it meant to just be John as a man and an artist, as a father and a husband. I've laid Hardcore Logo to rest, but for 12 years we were family, and I'll never forget that."
Oxenberger fronts an alt-country band, Solar Coagulant. They rarely tour, but play a few shows.
Just enough to keep me busy. You get a taste for being on stage, and it never really goes away."
He spends most of his time with his family, or organizing to increase the amount of sustainable energy and farming in his community.
"Some days, when I see the sun which grows our crops and can power our houses, I'll think about how Joe isn't there anymore. And I'm sad. But then I remember that he's still under the same sun, that his spirit is still with us, in our memories, and in the music."
Pipefitter. When I told him I wanted to talk about Hardcore Logo, he insisted that I call him Pipefitter, not Duncan. Says that he's Hardcore Logo's biggest fan.
"I'm doing some other stuff too, keeping busy, but there's nothing more important than Hardcore Logo."
Pipefitter is the band's staunchest advocate, the loudest voice calling for the label to keep their albums in print, and the one who made sure their lawyers got them a merchandising deal.
"Billy, well, doesn't want anything to do with anything. Sure, he still takes the checks, but he doesn't talk to us. Moved to Hollywood, and he doesn't want anything to do with us, but he doesn't get it. I'm still trying to make a living off this band."
Pipefitter has taken the helm of the business side of Hardcore Logo, not because he's qualified or best suited for the role, he readily admits.
"I had no idea what I was doing."
But no one else was going to do it, and that didn't sit right with him.
"Lots of times, a guy can die, a band can end, and just fade away. But I decided we couldn't. Hardcore Logo is too important to disappear. This f***ing band, man, it was the best thing that happened to me. I couldn't let it go away. That isn't what Joe would have wanted."
Hardcore Logo didn't start making money again until several years after Joe's death. When Joe Dick died, he left behind debts. The last tour didn't break even. There were financial commitments to McDonald and the film crew. There were legal fees associated with the illegitimate benefit concert. And after Joe's death, these fell to the band to take care of. A tribute album was released along with the movie. With that, the film, and increased awareness of Hardcore Logo's importance, the band started making some money. With a new manager to handle their legacy, Hardcore Logo finally became a part of the music industry that Joe Dick had hated so passionately. I want to talk about Joe's last interactions with his idol Bucky Haight, which were recorded on camera. Haight expressed disappointment with the way Joe had used him and severed all ties. This rejection by his mentor may have contributed to Joe's state of mind leading up to his suicide. Their falling out was not publicly known until the film's release, 10 months after Joe's death. Knowing about their break casts Haight's statement at the time in a different light. It's the lifestyle and the industry. The music business always wants a piece of you. Joe struggled with that for a long time. In the end, unable to stand losing any more pieces, Joe gave it all away. Bucky Haight died in 2008. His last album featured guitar by Billy Talent. I'm curious about what Haight would make of Hardcore Logo's legend. A cult band when Joe died, time and his suicide raised their profile considerably. Nowadays, shopping malls across North America carry Hardcore Logo merch, their t-shirts stacked next to Black Flag and Dead Kennedys gear, other 80s punks whose rebellion has been commodified on a scale the bands could have never imagined in their prime. It took long enough, but the music industry figured out how to make money from Hardcore Logo. In 2011, Hardcore Logo's complete discography was reissued in expanded editions, featuring live cuts and rare bonus tracks. A complete Hardcore Logo box set will set you back over $100, not that kids today pay money for music. When I was a teenager, their full lengths were available on CD, but all the singles and EPs were almost impossible to find. I had a friend who had a cousin who made me a cassette copy that I listened to until the tape wore out. Now I can stream it all to my phone. In 2000, a posthumous Joe Dick album of live acoustic tracks was released with his family's blessing. It's better than that sounds, but still an obvious cash-in. Shortly before his death, Joe was talking about the Sex Pistols' great rock and roll swindle. That's the context that his thinking was coming from. Joe had a plan. He organized a fake benefit show. He got a documentary crew to film their final shows. Joe's plan never got to a payday. He never enjoyed the filthy lucre promised by a rock and roll swindle. But maybe he was aiming for something else. Hardcore Logo were never a real rock and roll band. They were hardcore until the very end. Most hardcore bands evolve into something different. As a genre, hardcore is obsessed with purity and not selling out. Hardcore Logo are a rare band that lasted for more than a few years and never cashed in, at least not in Joe Dick's lifetime. For this story, I talked to Damien Abraham, aka Pink Eyes, the singer of a Canadian punk rock band whose name I can't say on air. There aren't a lot of Canadian punk bands, and few with the profile of Hardcore Logo, and I wanted to get his take on their influence. This was one of the first things he said to me.
Hardcore Logo never sold out. They were always fast, always hardcore. These days, everybody sells out. I mean, we sold out a long time ago.
What kind of influence did Hardcore Logo have on you guys?
I don't know. We were listening to all that 80s stuff, the hardcores, DOA, and like, they weren't one of my favorites, but it was cool to see other Canadians doing it too, you know? Punk is all about democratizing music. You can do it, I can do it. If they can do it, then anyone can do it. And the hardcores were great like that. Hardcore bands have a limited lifespan. Either you stop doing it, or it stops being hardcore, you know? Or you're just, like, doing hardcore songs because that's what people expect you to do, but that really isn't hardcore. It's kind of amazing that Hardcore Logo, they never got stuck in like that. Maybe it was their name. It kept them honest.
I've heard Hardcore Logo called a lot of different things before, but never honest. That's new. But I understand where Abraham's is coming from. Hardcore Logo never stopped being exactly what they wanted to be. Joe Dick never stopped racking hardcore cred, not even after his death. After he was buried, his finger bones were stolen out of his grave. Pipefitter sees the mystery as a positive thing.
I mean, Joe would have loved that. What's more f***ing punk rock than grave desecration?
The thief has never been found, though everyone has a theory. It was the American government, it was McDonald settling a score, it was Satanists. Pipefitter has spent a lot of time wondering.
It begs the question, right? of who's nuts enough about Joe to dig him up. Like, it's probably a fan. We always had some crazy fans, which was just the price of being as awesome as we were. Joe wouldn't mind that. He was always happy to have a fan touching his bone, if you know what I mean. Or like Billy, I guess. They're always like weird about each other. Weird as hell. Joe wouldn't be bothered by that either, having his bones rattle around in Billy's pockets. Not any different than when he was alive. Back in the good old days, anyway.
It all goes back to the good old days. We all talk about that last tour, about Joe's death, but they were a band for 13 years before that, toiling in relative obscurity. I didn't get into them until after the good old days, and I know that's true for a lot of people. There are hardcore Logo fans today who hadn't been born when Joe Dick died. That makes me feel old, but it also floors me with the staying power this band has had. Joe Dick's death cemented Hardcore Logo's legacy, guaranteed their legend. Some days I wonder if Joe Dick knew what he was doing, if he chose to become a rock and roll martyr over life without Hardcore Logo. Other days I don't understand it. His death seems incomprehensible. I only have questions. None of it makes sense. No matter what I think about the intentionality of their legacy, they're still my favorite band, partially because I haven't been able to solve them. It's been 20 years since Joe Dick's death, and there are still so many questions to ask. But his music is still with us, and I, for one, will always be grateful for that. This episode of This Canadian Life was produced by Best Liars and Bessie Boo for Pod Together 2015, with additional voice talent by White Haru 37, Easy Tangent, Boba Fenwick, and my father. Next, on the Culture Hour, our theater critic on Darren Nichols' giant puppet theater production of Waiting for Godot, an inhuman catastrophe or an innovative marriage of spectacle, voice acting, and marionettes? Is casting a real dog as Lucky going too far? We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening.